So that next on our agenda, on page 7, and that appears to be item B. J is our discussion item. This has previously been referred to. It's the alternative dispute resolution, the ethics standard for neutral arbitrators and contractual action. Arbitration, this is an action item previously mentioned by Justice Hull. Our speakers to this are Mary Roberts, General Counsel, and Ms. Henther Anderson, also of the Office of the General Counsel. We're a bit ahead of schedule.
And Chief Justice, I do believe we have public comment on this agenda item by Mr. Cliff Pilewski.
I'll get that from Nancy Spoon. Didn't have it. Thank you. Is Mr. Cliff Pilewski at the podium? Thank you. Sir, I'm not sure I pronounced your name correctly. Please correct me, and you may proceed. You have 5 minutes.
You got it right. Thank you very much, Your Honor, and members of the council. My name is Cliff Pilewski. I stand before you today on behalf of the California Employment Lawyers Association. We are very grateful for the effort here, and I don't know how often you hear praise, but we wanted to start by complimenting your staff. The original rules were an extraordinarily complicated endeavor, and these amendments are too, and I think the staff has done a great job. We fully support these amendments, especially the new disclosure rules. No system of justice can succeed without the confidence of its users. There's a whole bunch more involved in a justice system than moving money around, and the emotional component is critical. In consumer cases and mandatory cases, the process starts off at a disadvantage. Anytime a process that is selected by one party, when the providers and the rules are selected by one party and imposed on another, it creates the perception that there may be some disadvantage to the consumer party. So these rules really are very important. When they were originally proposed, there was a great hue and cry that the sky was going to fall, that arbitrators wouldn't be able to comply, they wouldn't comply, and arbitrators would flee, and that has not happened. In our mind, the rules have been very successful to the extent that they have been followed. And I can tell you that the larger providers, JAMS and AAA, have done a very good job of attempting to comply with the postings and with the disclosures. Unfortunately, many of the smaller providers are not complying with the posting requirements and certainly not providing all of the disclosures that are required. I think the staff has done a very good job of identifying the issues. There was only one comment that I just wanted to address before I make some suggestions for some of the gaps. One of the commenters said that the focus of the rules should be ferreting out bias and not the moral character of the arbitrator. I don't think I could disagree with that more. It is an awesome responsibility, dispensing justice, as you all know. And the moral character of the arbitrator goes to the heart of the process. There's nothing more important in justice, to justice, and to the arbitration process than the moral character of the arbitrator. So I really support these rules. I have some suggestions for you for gaps that you might consider in the future. I think the suggestion of a model checklist is a great idea. It must include Standard 8. I think a lot of the providers stop at Standard 7 and they are not making the disclosures required of the providers. And this is especially important because of the recent experiences with the National Arbitration Forum. You may or may not know that the National Arbitration Forum, which was probably the second or third largest national provider, as a result of enforcement actions by the Attorney General of Minnesota and the City Attorney of San Francisco, have been prohibited from conducting consumer arbitrations nationally and in California. It turns out that they were using arbitration as a collection device and that the owners of the debt, the collection services, actually secretly bought 40% or $40 million worth of the National Arbitration Forum, and they refused to disclose that, failed to disclose it. The Attorney General of Minnesota uncovered it and Congress had hearings. It enhances one of the big holes in these rules as to the providers. The providers make the rules, select the arbitrators, sometimes appoint the arbitrators, rule on cause issues, and they are such an important part of the process. The rules don't presently require the providers to identify their owners. If the owners of the providers were provided, we might have avoided some of the problems with the National Arbitration Forum. I also think that there's a problem with the rules as they are presently set up does not require the arbitrator to disclose any economic relationship between a party and the provider. And the explanation was that it wasn't necessary because arbitration providers are precluded from administering cases. Well, obviously, the National Arbitration Forum did not abide by that and did not make the disclosures, so I think it would be very helpful to require a disclosure of who actually are the owners of the providers. I suggest also that there's no real enforcement mechanism, that when the rules first went into effect, the disclosure rules, the National Arbitration Forum refused to comply. So we represented the chair of the Assembly Judiciary Committee at the time, who helped draft the rules, Assemblywoman Corbett, and brought a lawsuit against the National Arbitration Forum on her behalf. Their position was the Federal Arbitration Act preempted these rules, and they had no obligation to provide. And unfortunately, because there is no economic damage when you're trying to enforce compliance with these rules, presently no individual or no consumer has standing. And so there's no real way to enforce the rules if the providers themselves don't comply. Another hole in the rules is that right now, arbitrators are required to make disclosures, and if they don't, you can disqualify them. But there's no mechanism to disqualify an entire provider. If, in fact, the providers are not providing the disclosures, that would be a problem that would apply to every single arbitrator. And so there needs to be some way to get out of that morass rather than having to go through 17 separate arbitrators and to disclose them. I also would suggest and urge you to make it a little bit easier to find the rules. They used to be as part of the appendix to the Civil Procedure Code, and I don't think they're there anymore. And it's very important. And maybe we can work with the legislature to find a way to make them easier to find so that consumers, especially those who lack sophistication, know where to go. Quickly, just two or three other small points. Marketing. The rules place almost no limitation on marketing. The original ethical rules created by the ABA and the American Arbitration Association prohibited arbitrators from soliciting cases on their own behalf. That's such an important rule. There's a new organization called the Commercial Arbitrators Association who unfortunately eliminated all marketing obligations. The notion of having arbitrators or agents of theirs go to particular companies or large corporations and say, give us all of your cases because we have this panel, we have these rules, really is inconsistent with the perception of neutrality that is required. So I would ask you to take a much closer look at that. Another, and perhaps my next to last, one of the problems we're having in the field, under many circumstances, the employer and sometimes the company is required to pay the full cost of arbitration for a lot of good reasons, to provide access to justice. In my mind, it's always been better to make arbitration voluntary and have the cost split. The problem that arises when you have one party paying the cost, and it's happening a lot, is that if the party doesn't like the way the arbitration's going, they stop paying. And the providers are saying, we're not going to give you the award, we're not going to finish the arbitration, leaving the consumer and the employee with no remedy whatsoever. Among the disclosures that you might have is an arbitrator and the provider must identify whether they're willing to follow through and complete the process if the defendant or one of the parties stops paying. I realize my time is up. Thank you very much.
Mr. Pileski, thank you. Those are very helpful comments to us.
Yes.
A question, Mr. Pileski, before you step away from the podium. Have your concerns been reduced to writing and provided to the AOC?
I have not produced them in writing. I've been working with the Assembly Judiciary Committee. I had a conversation with Heather Anderson yesterday. I was unaware of this process until I read the story in the Daily Journal. But I'm more than happy to follow through in any way that you think would be efficient.
Thank you. I think it would be helpful for you to memorialize that so we have it available to us as we consider future rules. Obviously, here we have a set of recommendations that is really
right.
Focused more on the standards of the arbitrators as a result of case law. But this is, you raised some very interesting points, and we would like to hear further on that, Mr. Pileski.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the Council, and Jody. As the slide in front of you indicates, this topic is the proposal to amend the ethics standards for neutral arbitrators and contractual arbitration. These are standards, not rules technically, that the Council adopted in 2002 in accordance with legislative direction. I will give a brief introduction and background about the standards, and then I'm going to turn it over to Heather Anderson, who is here with me. Heather is a senior attorney in the Office of the General Counsel and a nationally recognized expert in the field of alternative dispute resolution. Heather has worked in this area for over 20 years, including as lead staff to the Blue Ribbon Panel of Experts on Arbitrator Ethics that assisted the Council in developing the standards that have been in place now for more than 10 years. So let me clarify at the start that these standards apply to private arbitrators, not to arbitrators. Let's go back to the first one. Yeah. Not to arbitrators who serve in the court's judicial arbitration programs, nor to arbitrators who serve pursuant to labor contracts or collective bargaining agreements. The Judicial Council was tasked with adopting standards by statute. In 2001, the legislature enacted Code of Civil Procedure 1281.85, which requires the Council to adopt ethics standards. So the Council went to work immediately with the expert panel that former Chief Justice Ronald M. George established. The statute required that the Council adopt ethics standards to be effective on July 1 of 2002. And these standards were to apply and do apply to all neutral arbitrators serving in arbitrations under an arbitration agreement and requiring all persons serving as neutral arbitrators under an arbitration agreement to comply with these standards. The legislative history of the statute indicates that the goals of establishing and requiring compliance with these ethics standards included to ensure that parties can have confidence in the integrity and fairness of private arbitrators, which is especially important given the limited judicial review of arbitration awards. To understand the role and importance of the ethics standards, let me highlight some of the unique features of private contractual arbitrations to which these standards apply. There is no license or other credential that's required for a person to serve as a private arbitrator, nor is there any public office or public body that either vets individuals before they may serve as private arbitrators or that disciplines private arbitrators for inappropriate, unprofessional, or unethical behavior. Decisions of arbitrators in contractual arbitration are binding on parties, and the grounds for judicial review of their arbitration decisions, which are established by statute, are very, very limited. An arbitrator's decision cannot be overturned or vacated on the basis that the arbitrator made a mistake of either fact or law. Because of the limitations on review of arbitrators' decisions, selecting an appropriate person to serve as an arbitrator in a case becomes critical. The extensive disclosure requirements for arbitrators in both statute and in the ethics standards are intended to assist parties in making this crucial choice. In addition, to protect parties and encourage compliance with these disclosure requirements, the legislature has provided that one of the limited grounds for a court to vacate an arbitrator's decision is if the arbitrator failed to disclose, within the time required for disclosure, a ground for disqualification of which the arbitrator was then aware. So the disclosure requirements in the ethics standard serve not only to help parties select an appropriate person to serve as an arbitrator, but if an arbitrator fails to make a required disclosure, it creates the potential basis for overturning the arbitrator's award. So with that history, let me turn now to November 2001, when the Chief Justice Ronald M. George appointed the Blue Ribbon Panel of Experts on Arbitrator Ethics. This panel comprised 18 members, including law school faculty, sitting and retired judges, legislative and executive branch representatives, business, consumer, and labor representatives, and practicing arbitrators. This panel was tasked with reviewing and providing input on drafts of the ethics standards for arbitrators that were prepared by AOC staff. The expert panel was chaired by USF Law School Professor Jay Fulberg, former dean, and himself a nationally known expert in the field of ADR. In April of 2002, the Council adopted the ethics standards for neutral arbitrators in contractual arbitration in order to meet the statutory deadline, but also directed the AOC to recirculate the standards in order to have a more robust period for public comment. And incidentally, and I don't know that there's anybody on the council except perhaps Justice Baxter who may recall this, that promptly after the council adopted the ethics standards, the council was sued by the New York Stock Exchange and by the National Association of Securities Dispute Resolution Group, these self-regulatory agencies under federal securities law. They sued the council seeking a declaration that the ethics standards are preempted by the national security regulatory scheme. We responded to that lawsuit, and it was dismissed by the federal court in November of 2002 and later appealed by the NASD to the Ninth Circuit. And while it was pending on appeal, both the Ninth Circuit and our own California Supreme Court decided the issue that was of such concern to the security arbitration industry and concluded that, in fact, the ethics standards as applied to arbitrators in security industry arbitrations were preempted by federal law. So the appeal that was then pending in our lawsuit was dismissed as moot. And back to the timeline. In December of 2002, the council amended the standards based on the public comment that it received at the time. The standards have not been amended since December of 2002. So in the approximately 10 years since their adoption, there have been several cases addressing these standards, and the AOC has also received some suggestions for amending the standards. So with that background, now I'm going to turn it over to Heather Anderson to speak in more detail about the proposed amendments.
Can you hear me in this mic, or do I need to move?
I can hear you, but you need to speak up.
How's that?
That's better.
Okay,
better.
Thank you. The proposal that's before you includes a number of recommended amendments to the arbitrator ethics standards, including codifying the case law that Mary just spoke of regarding preemption of the standards by the SEC-approved rules for securities arbitrators, clarifying that arbitrators have to disclose if their spouse or domestic partner has a prior association in the practice of law within the last 2 years with a lawyer in the arbitration, clarifying that the standards govern both initial and supplemental disclosures, and also adding a requirement that arbitrators make disclosures regarding professional discipline imposed on them by a professional or occupational disciplinary agency. As Mary, I think, mentioned, this proposal was circulated for public comment during last spring from April through June. And the only change that garnered significant public comment was the proposal to amend Standard 7E to require the disclosure of public disciplinary actions. The specific language that's proposed is on page 24 and 25 of your report, and it would provide that in addition to the matters that must be disclosed under subdivision D of Standard 7, that's the subdivision that addresses disclosures relating to impartiality, a proposed arbitrator or arbitrator must also disclose First, if the arbitrator has been disbarred or had his or her license to practice a profession or occupation revoked by a professional or occupational disciplinary agency or licensing board, whether in California or elsewhere. If the arbitrator has resigned his or her membership in the state bar or another professional or occupational licensing agency or board, whether in California or elsewhere, while disciplinary charges are pending, or if within the preceding 10 years, public discipline other than that imposed above has been imposed on the arbitrator by a professional or occupational disciplinary agency or licensing board, whether in California or elsewhere. The proposed standard also includes a definition of public discipline as disciplinary action imposed on the arbitrator that the professional or occupational disciplinary agency or licensing board identifies in its publicly available records or in response to a request for information about the arbitrator from a member of the public. This particular proposal was developed in response to a 2010 decision by the California Supreme Court in Haworth versus Superior Court. That case involved a retired judge who was serving as an arbitrator who had been publicly censured by the Commission on Judicial Performance while he was a judge. A party in that arbitration discovered the information about this censure after the arbitrators, it was a panel of three arbitrators, issued their award and sought to overturn that award on the basis that the arbitrator failed to disclose the information about the public censure. Because the arbitrator ethics standards, neither the standards nor the statutes relating to arbitrator disclosure currently require disclosure specifically of professional discipline, the courts that looked at this had to analyze this under the general standard relating to impartiality, which is in Standard 7D, and that standard is whether a person aware of the facts the information could cause a person aware of those facts to reasonably entertain a doubt that the arbitrator would be able to be impartial. In the Haworth case, it took 4 years and two trips from the Superior Court to the Court of Appeal to the Supreme Court for a final determination to be made that in the facts of this particular case, this particular censure was not something that the court felt met that disclosure obligation relating to impartiality. The proposed amendment to the standards would enact a specific requirement for disclosure of professional discipline. The goal is, by creating a clearer standard for disclosure, to avoid this kind of protracted litigation about whether a particular disciplinary action meets the requirement for disclosure relating to impartiality, support the finality of arbitration awards, and enhance public confidence in the integrity of private arbitrators and the private arbitration system as a whole. It's not unusual for individuals who are serving in a capacity like an arbitrator to be required to provide information about a public professional discipline. This is information that candidates for appointment to the Superior Court bench have to disclose to the governor. Attorneys are required to disclose this information to the State Bar of California. Mediators in court-connected mediation programs for civil cases are required under our rules to disclose this information to the court. And neutrals serving in the Los Angeles Superior Court ADR programs and the programs of other courts are required, including judicial arbitrators, are required to provide this information to the court. The difference is that in these situations, there's a public official or public body whose job it is to vet the individual to determine whether they meet all of the criteria that you would want for somebody who's going to decide your dispute. In the case of private arbitration, there is no such public body. The determination of who serves as an arbitrator is made by the parties. So this proposal would have the information go to those who are making the determination about who serves the parties. We also note that this information, this same type of information is currently required to be disclosed under the securities arbitration rules, those that are approved by the SEC, They require disclosure of professional discipline on a checklist, and that checklist is provided to the parties to help them in selecting an arbitrator. As I mentioned before, this proposal was circulated for public comment. We specifically sought comment on whether the standard should include a requirement for disclosure of public professional discipline, and we got comments back from 8 individuals and organizations. 5 of those supported including this in the ethics standards. 1 didn't take a position but provided some input on the language of it, and 2 commentators opposed this. It was opposed by Judge Daniel Hanlon, John Warnoff, and Peter Mankin, who commented together based on concerns that would be requiring disclosure of information that the Supreme Court in the Haworth case felt was remote and irrelevant to the issue of impartiality, and their view that the disclosure should be limited to only to those issues related to the arbitrator's ability to be impartial. It was also opposed by the California Judges Association on the basis that the disclosure requirements for arbitrators should be the same as the disclosure obligations for sitting judges, because they're in a similar capacity of determining the outcome of a case. In response to all of the public comments, the AOC made a number of changes in the proposal as a whole, and specifically to this provision relating to disclosure of professional discipline, including limiting the disclosure of things other than disbarments or requirements to leave a profession in a discipline that had been imposed within the prior 10 years, and adding a definition of public discipline that you see before you. The AOC recommends that the Council adopt this proposed requirement to disclose professional discipline. That recommendation reflects the AOC's conclusions that, again, the Haworth case was focused on whether these disclosures were required under the standard for impartiality in that particular case, and that's not what's being recommended here. What's being recommended is a disclosure obligation that is separate from disclosures relating to impartiality and goes to other issues that may be important to those who are selecting arbitrators, including the integrity of the individual who would be deciding their case. That the ethics standards are focused on more than disclosures about impartiality. They include many other provisions, and the disclosure obligations that are already there are different from the disclosure obligations of sitting judges. And that's because sitting judges and arbitrators are in different situations in a variety of ways, one of which, again, is that there isn't a public body that vets arbitrators. The parties are the only ones that are having a say in whether this individual serves as their arbitrator. And finally, that these potential changes will further the overall goals of the ethics standards by making avoiding litigation in this area and supporting the integrity of arbitrators and of the arbitration process as a whole. If, however, the council decides that this particular provision shouldn't be adopted, then the language that I read to you and was on the previous slides would simply be removed from the proposal that's before you. There would not be any provision 7E1 regarding professional discipline. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Heather. Judge Rosenberg?
Thank you for that report. I have 2 questions. Number one, where did that 10-year requirement come from? Is that an arbitrary number? Why not 7, 8, 9, 12, 5?
It was actually one of the suggestions that came from State Bar of California's ADR committee, that there be a limit, and their suggestion was 5 or 10 years, and the draft was modified to include the 10 years before it was circulated for comment.
Why did you pick 10 instead of 5? again, arbitrary? Flip a coin?
I don't think it's necessarily arbitrary. I think that that the public discipline of an individual, the implications of that may last longer than a 5-year period.
When no, even felons get a 5-year washout period.
Well, in the Supreme Court's review in the Haworth case, they specifically kind of keyed on that 10-year period as the basis for thinking that that particular disciplinary action was too old to be relevant to the issue of impartiality.
My second question is, I don't really understand why we need a more stringent rule than we have with regard to a judge's disclosure. You know, this is private arbitration. I have to believe that the parties are big boys and girls. Government doesn't have to solve everyone's problem and protect everyone. I just don't see why we need a more stringent rule for private arbitrators than we would have for ethical disclosure for judges. That's a policy call, right?
It certainly is a policy call, and that's why this issue is before the council, as Justice Hull indicated in his remarks. But just to underscore the significant difference between judges and commercial arbitration, it's a very, very limited opportunity to appeal in arbitrations. And frankly, I think in many, many cases, especially given the popularity of commercial arbitrations, you often do have rather unsophisticated individuals who are participating in arbitrations because that is the forum that that they find themselves in.
Judge Friedman, then Judge Rubin.
Thank you, Chief. I can't vote on this. I'm not a voting member, but I do have some comments to offer as somebody who performs contractual arbitration. If I was a voting member, I perhaps would recuse myself, so I'm just going to offer these observations based upon my own experience, which actually started when I was in the legislature, because the initial statute that was enacted to compel private arbitrators to disclose potential conflicts, which is now embodied in CCP 1281.9, came before the legislature in 1994. And I recall at that time that there were a number of private arbitrators who contacted me and urged me to oppose the legislation on the grounds that the process is private. It's one that the parties should be able to entirely craft on their own and make their decisions on their own. I thought that was an unwise position to take, because it seemed to me then, as it does now, that the public is entitled to transparency in order to have confidence in the outcome of a process which, though it is not our formal judicial system, it is part of the administration of justice in California, and a growing part of it. Unfortunately, with all of the cuts that are occurring, impacting our courts, more and more litigants, not just at the top of the food chain, major companies, but individuals are pursuing arbitration as a less costly and faster way of obtaining a result. So it seems to me, in order to, as it did then, to enhance public confidence and enhance transparency in a system that is connected to what we do every day, that the more sunshine, as Justice Brandeis said many years ago, the better. So I offer those comments just to provide a little bit of perspective from somebody who's encountered this issue as a policymaker and currently now as an arbitrator who would find no problem whatsoever with complying with these new disclosure requirements.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge Rubin.
Thank you, Chief. CJA is standing by its position on this. We feel like that you did a good job in sort of summarizing our position. We're going to stand by it. I guess I have a question. One of the key reasons that you suggest that this disclosure requirement be amended, it has to do with finality, and we kind of point to the Horwath case as an example, but Has anyone done a study of how many cases have been overturned because of a lack of disclosure? Do we know that? Apparently somebody does.
Eating.
Edith, yes. I certainly don't claim to know how many, but in my limited experience of representing lawyers and also in one case a arbitration provider, I have had at least four cases in which a arbitration ruling was challenged as a result of a disclosure issue. And the difficulty of that is very large for the litigants, because in each of those cases there were substantial attorney's fees that had been spent on both sides for the arbitration, and then of course there was a result that was being set aside, and if the parties were to redo the arbitration, there's always the lack of certainty as to whether the second arbitration result will be the same as the first. It's also of concern, and this is slightly off point, but in case people are not aware in the room, the case law in California basically immunizes both the arbitrator and the arbitration provider, and so from any failure to disclose. That is considered, even a failure to disclose as part of the arbitration process, and is considered within the penumbra of judicial immunity. What that does to the bar is that it means that the only remedy when a arbitration award is set aside for the client is to turn to the lawyer and say, you should have figured out that this guy was going to get disqualified.
Okay, but if we're going to amend...
Sorry about that.
Ms. Mathai, but even if we're going to amend this rule this way, it seems to be unfair if we're talking about some fraction or some, you know, less than 1% or 2% of the cases. It just seems like this could be an overreach and swinging at a rather small problem with a rather large hammer. And that's kind of, I guess, our concern. It does seem to put arbitrators at a disadvantage. It doesn't seem fair. And I also agree with Judge Rosenberg's position, which is, and even if you're going to do this, that's fine, except that even felons have a washout period that's better than this. And the argument that the Jenny form somehow provides, you know, for sitting judges is some sort of answer to at least part of our objection. The Jenny form could be removed from the actual discipline by 10, 12 years. That is to say that discipline can come down any time in a judge's career. So... That's CJ's position, I guess. And I guess you answered the question for Ms. Is it Harrison?
Anderson.
Justice Hull.
Thank you, Chief. First of all, I do appreciate Judge Rosenberg's point that these are private contractual arbitrations. On the other hand, it's apparent that they're not final, that they do end up in the courts. I don't know with what frequency, but at least frequently enough that perhaps these matters could be avoided if we had a rule along these lines. And my question for Judge Rubin or any of us here or anybody that can help me with this, and I don't expect Judge Rubin for you to know all of the details of every member of your organization, but I understand that part of the objection is that this would make a rule that was different than rules for sitting judges. But beneath that, what is the objection?
I didn't hear you.
Beneath the stated objection that it creates a difference. Why would private arbitrators object to this? The only way I can think of that they'd object to it is that they have something in their background that they'd prefer not to disclose.
Well, I think that's obviously one interpretation. And of course I don't know the thoughts of all of them. I think the essence of it just seems unfair to them and it puts them at a disadvantage. And some of the, I mean, I think it may be part of a larger conversation that we're having about discipline, generally speaking, and that some of it seems to be not as consistent with sort of general norms of what should be disciplined, and they're being forced to disclose things that their colleagues didn't have to do when they were a judge 2 weeks ago. They didn't have to do, and so that I think that has more to do with fairness, I think.
Thank you.
Thank you. Justice Baxter?
I think it, by implication, I think the Hayworth opinion would have been the same had this rule existed, because in that case the the public censure was over 10 years beyond. You know, the problem, and I'm going to vote for this, but the problem I have is this should not be an AOC recommendation. And I think we have to look at our process a little bit here. I guess standards don't go through rules, and maybe they should. I'm looking at the relationship between the AOC and the California Judges Association as an example. I'd feel so much more comfortable if this matter was presented to us as a proposal by the Rules Committee, by the Policy Committee, by the Blue Ribbon Task Force Committee. But I feel very uncomfortable, and I think we're leading with our chin when it's presented on behalf of the AOC. And I just say that, I just make that comment because I think we should think, and I think it's important to think that through. There are a number of members of the California Judges Association who I think feel that this is an invasion of some sort. And it really needs to come from a judicial council committee of one sort or another to be vetted and then presented. I think it makes it very uncomfortable for the AOC for this to be emanating from the AOC. That's all I have to say.
Justice Hall.
Thank you, Chief. In response to Justice Baxter's comments, which I certainly take to heart, I just wanted to advise the Council that one of the projects that RuPro has on its tentative agenda this year, I know that guidelines don't come through RuPro. That's my understanding, Debbie. Is that correct? Okay. What about standards? I don't know the answer to that.
Standards of Judicial Administration would come to RuPro, but it's not. But I think Heather can also address a little bit of council members of the Blue Ribbon panel that was done to address some of those concerns that Mrs. Cox raised. And in addition, these would come back to RuPro before coming to council.
All right. I would only note that this is a topic of discussion, whether it's a guideline, it's a standard, or it's a rule, as to whether or not we need to take a look at these issues or at this issue and decide if we're proceeding in the best interests, in the absolutely most effective interests or effective manner for these various matters that affect people. But Ms. Anderson, as Ms. Brown said, you have something to add, I guess.
I did want to mention that although we did not reconstitute the Blue Ribbon panel, we did send a draft of the standards, a preliminary draft of the standards, to all the members of that panel, and almost all of them responded to that and provided input. Those members of the Blue Ribbon panel were also sent the version that was sent out for public comment. And in addition to that, even before we went to the Blue Ribbon panel, we shared what we were thinking about doing with members of the legislature and legislative staff who had originally been involved in the enactment of CCP section 1281.85. So we did seek input, but the name on this is the AOC, and if the council wants that to be something different in the future, if and when we bring other amendments, then certainly we should be looking at that.
Justice Miller.
Justice Baxter, I agree wholeheartedly with what you said, and so I just leaned over to our new interim director and asked if she couldn't look and find out if there are any other issues like this out there that have been in some way assigned or given to the AOC so that we can discuss those and determine if there are appropriate judicial committees or judicial council committees that those should work through first. And so we'll have a report back on that, and we'll do that through E&P and then make a recommendation to the council. And then lastly, I'd make a motion to approve the ethics standards for neutral arbitrators and contractual arbitration as set forth in item J.
Second. Second by Judge Yu. Justice Baxter.
Mary, can you tell us, this isn't an automatic rule that would cause the award to be vacated as a matter of law, is it? In other words, let's assume that you have something that's not disclosed, but everyone knows about it. I mean, it's just obvious, and everybody agrees they know about it, both sides. And then after the party loses, I know this was an issue that came up during the Hayworth case. After the party loses, even having known about that failure to disclose, is it an automatic vacating of that arbitration award? Is it intended to do that? I don't read it that way.
No, it's not intended to be an automatic basis for vacating an award.
Okay.
Judge Wesley.
Thank you. I know there's been a motion, but I'll make a substitute motion to defer vote on this and to refer it to
Rupert. Second. I'll second.
So in terms of the substitute motion that's been made by Judge Wesley and seconded by Judge Rosenberg and Mr. Mark Robinson, any further discussion on that before we take up the vote on the substitute motion? All in favor of the substitute motion, say aye.
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 Any opposed?
No.
Then the matter passes.
Passes.
And so at this time, then, it's the matter of recommendation found on pages 2 through 3 and is transferred to RUPRO for discussion and vetting through any appropriate Judicial Council advisory committees before being brought back to council in your estimation.
So that was part of your motion, right, Judge Wesley?
Yes.
Go to RUPRO and they decide if there's an appropriate.
Absolutely. That's how I think
I'm fine with that.
Proper procedure, yes.
Miriam.
One or more, yeah.
So I understand. I think the process, obviously, it's an improvement in the process. Given the fact that there already has, you know, as Heather described it, been input and vetting, et cetera, I'm just wondering if implicit in that motion maybe could be the intent of the council that it move on a quick track, that you know, it not go through the normal sort of year-long RUPRO process, just that we're hoping to have RUPRO review it, give its seal of approval or not, and try to have it come back to the council pretty quickly. So, and I'm assuming
that
was implicit in Judge Wesley's motion.
I don't think there's any disagreement with that, Justice Hall.
No, that's perfectly okay. I agree.
Thank you. And in terms of the public comment that was made here today by Mr. Pilevsky regarding any recommendations, then I think that's also something that should be, if it comes into the hands of the AOC, it should be referred to RUPRO, and RUPRO can decide how to proceed with that and the priority of that and how it fits into the agenda of the advisory committees under your purview.
We'll do that also, Chief. Thank you.
Thank you.
One final comment I'd like to make, because there was some question about should these be rules or standards or guidelines or what. The legislation that requires the council to adopt standards does use the word standards as opposed to rules or more expansive description. I don't know that in 2001 the council ever considered alternatives to standards. My vague recollection is that there wasn't a discussion about that, but this was presented as standards because that's what the legislation had directed. So.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mary. Thank you,
You're
Heather.
Welcome. On a total, a different subject, Chief, to referring back to the conversation regarding the public contract code.
Yes.
Several minutes ago, I think I misspoke in terms of the operative date of the new requirements, and just so the record's clear, the new legislation was enacted in March of 2001 with an operative date of October 1. I think I said November 1. Okay, I want to correct myself for the record.
Thank 2011. You. I appreciate that,
Mary. What did I say, 2001? I'm losing my mind, Judge Rosenberg. You're right, 2011.
You're
time is flying.
Correcting the correction.
I'll correct the correction. Thank you so much.